This is West Southwest. I'm Sevilla Mann. This Saturday marks 5 years since an Enbridge Energy oil pipeline ruptured near Marshall. It poured more than 800,000 gallons of crude oil into Talmadge Creek and the Kalamazoo River. No inland oil spill in the United States has ever been larger. And while 5 years later the cleanup is mostly done, the state says complete restoration will take years. To talk about the impact of the spill, we're joined by Carl Weimer. He's the executive director of the Pipeline Safety Trust, a Washington state nonprofit group that advocates for stricter regulation of oil pipelines. Weimer serves on a U.S. Department of Transportation pipeline safety panel and has testified to Congress about pipeline regulations. Carl Weimer, welcome to West Southwest.
Thanks for having me on today.
I want to get a sense of where the 2010 spill near Marshall fits among oil spills in North America. It's the largest inland spill in the U.S. to date, but have others approached it in size?
There's been some other ones that are of a similar size. Some of them were caused by big natural disasters, such as major floods in Texas caused some big spills over a decade ago. There's been a number of other ones that have been quite a bit smaller, but have done quite a bit of environmental damage, including the recent one into the ocean near Santa Barbara, California.
That was just a few weeks ago, a month ago?
Yeah, I think it was a month, maybe 6 weeks ago now, an oil pipeline ruptured and flowed down across the beach and dumped about 100,000 gallons altogether. So it was almost, you know, only 10% of the Marshall, Michigan spill, but 20,000 gallons of it ended up into the Pacific Ocean and did considerable environmental harm.
That was not only an oil spill, but a pipeline spill. So throughout North America, how common are spills from oil pipelines as opposed to wells or other oil sources?
Yeah, the reality is that there's a significant incident on these types of hazardous liquid pipelines about every 2.5 days somewhere in the country. And significant incident is defined in federal regulations as an incident that either kills someone, puts someone in the hospital, does $50,000 worth of property damage, or spills significant amount of product.
And among those spills, is it more commonly one or the other of those things? Is it most often that a large amount of oil was spilled? Is it more often that someone's hurt?
These oil spills tend not to cause, you know, fatalities and injuries as much as natural gas pipelines do, but they do a lot of property damage, just the spill volumes themselves kind of kick these spills into the federal database. So I think it's a kind of a combination of the property damage $50,000 threshold along with the 50 barrels of oil spilled is what would count as a significant incident.
And you said an incident that counts as significant happens every 2.5 days?
Yeah,
so,
about every 2.5 days. There's an average over the last 3 years of 150 of them a year somewhere in the country.
Mm-hmm. Inside Climate News reported in 2012 that Enbridge Energy knew of corroded spots in its line near Marshall years before the spill. How often does a problem with the integrity of the line play a role in a pipeline spill?
Yeah, it's one of the major problems. I mean, if you look at the causes of pipeline incidents around the country, there's a whole range of causes, but the vast majority of them, 70 or 80% of all the pipeline incidents, are caused by things that the pipeline companies say they can deal with through their testing and maintenance, things like corrosion, welding on the pipelines, the way they operate the pipelines. So a high percentage are things that are supposed to be covered under a company's integrity management plan. And as we found out in Marshall and a number of spills since then, the companies are not always assessing the risks of their pipelines correctly.
Yeah. What would you say should have changed policy-wise or practice-wise following the Marshall spill or following other incidents?
The National Transportation Safety Board, particularly after the Marshall spill, came out with a number of recommendations that they say would help prevent these types of accidents. And some of them are being more specific in the regulations for how companies have to assess their pipelines. When NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, released their report on the Kalamazoo spill, you know, it was kind of a wake-up call that Enbridge, in that case, had not been doing their risk assessment properly. They had one group of people looking at corrosion on the pipeline. They had another group of people looking at cracking on the pipeline. And the two groups hadn't communicated with each other very well. So they had places where there was corrosion that had significantly eaten away on the walls of the pipe. And they had other places where they knew there had cracks that were partially through the pipe. But they had never overlaid those two and know that they had cracks on top of pipe that was corroded. That's why the pipeline ended up failing there. Even though Enbridge knew that they both had cracks and corrosion, they just had never added them together. What really needs to happen with these companies kind of creating their own risk management systems is more specific regulations to, so when they know certain things are going on, they have to follow up and dig the pipeline up and assess it more directly.
Does it currently largely fall to the company that operates the pipeline to look at that pipe and say, hey, it's in good shape, or no, it needs repairs?
It really does. I mean, that's one of the things that's somewhat frustrating to the public in the federal regulations is a lot of the federal regulations are kind of left up to the companies. The regulations say you need to have a risk management plan. You need to know what kind of pipe you have in the ground and then design your plan to mitigate for the types of risks you identify, but it allows them a whole lot of wiggle room and some would say loopholes for each company coming up with their own plans, none of which are the same, which also makes them almost impossible for a regulator to regulate or enforce against.
And has anything changed since 2010 or since another spill? You would think that perhaps that incident would have prompted some change in those regulations.
Yeah, there really hasn't been much change yet. You know, after the Michigan spill and a number of other incidents that have happened in the last 5 years, there's been some movement. We know that the federal regulator, the Pipeline Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, sometimes referred to as PHMSA, has drafted new regulations for this type of pipe that probably includes things like these integrity management plans, includes things like better leak detection, better automated valves, all things that kind of were recommendations after these incidents. But those draft regulations, some of which started 5 years ago, still have not been finalized. So to a grand degree, as far as the regulations go, nothing has changed. I think Enbridge as a specific company probably saw the handwriting on the wall and has done a whole lot of things to perhaps improve their own system. But as far as the overall national regulations to prevent this from happening somewhere else or with a different company, little has changed.
You would think it would be in the interest of the company that operates the pipeline to not have spills. Enbridge has spent, I think, more than $1 billion now on the cleanup here. I'm sure most of these spills don't amount to that large sum of money, but surely it must be expensive and time-consuming for them, aside from, on principle, not wanting to spill the oil.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, companies kind of hate both the public relations nightmare that occurs after a spill, because not only does the oil damage the environment, I think it sometimes damages the company's reputations. Plus, it costs them a lot of money and a lot of time. Although often, if you go and look at the bottom line with some of these large companies, you know, they're making, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars every quarter of the year. So sometimes the amount it costs to clean up these spills, or certainly the small fines that they get for them, probably are not really enough to change their behavior significantly.
Excuse me. Right. It would seem like maybe not, because on the flip side there, if you have some kind of pipeline incident happening every couple of days, maybe there's not quite enough incentive there to make sure these pipes don't have holes in them.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. You know, and I think there's good companies that have taken all this to heart, and the industry as a whole, you know, has a mantra that they all repeat, that their number one goal is zero incidents, so that's good. There has been some other changes. The industry themselves has adopted a new standard for safety management systems, which is supposed to prevent the type of problems that Enbridge had, where when the left hand didn't communicate very well with the right hand. So there's been movements within particular companies and within the industry itself, but the regulations that actually hold maybe the slaggards in the pipeline industry to a higher standard have not really changed much yet.
How does the industry tend to react to suggestions that it do less self-policing and that the government do more of that looking at pipelines for the industry?
Well, they always kind of push back on that. They certainly like the flexibility that the current regulations give them. And it's true that every pipeline is a little different. So, you know, it's hard to write regulations that one size fits all because pipelines go through different types of terrain, over mountains, under rivers, you know, under the Great Lakes in some place even. So you certainly have different risks and in different mitigation strategies depending on where the pipeline is. So there needs to be some flexibility, but I think the National Transportation Safety Board has clearly identified that there's a little bit too much flexibility in the regulations at this point.
Enbridge's 6B pipeline near Marshall was carrying a kind of crude oil that was even heavier and sludgier and had more benzene in it, it sounds like, than regular crude. Does it matter what kind of oil is moving through your local pipeline?
Yeah, it matters for a number of reasons. Certainly some of the heavier crude oils, they're thicker, so it takes more kind of pressure to push them through the pipeline. So there's some consideration that, especially if you have an old pipeline like Enbridge had that had cracking problems, that trying to push that heavier oil through the pipeline could have been one of the problems that could have caused that pipeline to crack faster. And certainly if it comes out of the pipeline, if there's an accident or a spill that dumps the stuff, the heavy crude acts very differently in the water. And that's certainly, I think, the Kalamazoo spill was a wake-up call nationally that, oh, we're moving more and more of these heavy types of crude from the oil sands of Alberta and other places that, you know, if it comes out and it starts mixing with the water and the sediment a little bit, instead of staying on the surface where a boom might catch the oil, it starts to sink and ends up on the bottom of the water, at which point, you know, even the Coast Guard has said out loud, we don't really know how to clean up oil once it sinks.
Right. I do seem to remember that was a major issue with the spill here, and that it was a surprise to the state environmental agencies and the federal environmental agencies when they arrived here and saw the oil sinking. And I imagine now that wouldn't come as much of a surprise because of that. When it comes to moving oil by rail as opposed to pipelines, is moving oil by train, is that specifically a move away from transporting it through pipelines?
I don't think it's really a move away from transporting it by pipelines. You know, moving it by pipelines tends to be cheaper, and I think most people would say safer than moving it by rail. Most of the move towards rail has just been to get into new production areas like North Dakota, the Bakken crude in North Dakota. There really aren't any pipelines into that area, so there was already rail, so it was a fast way to start moving that oil while perhaps the pipelines caught up. And we're seeing that movement now. You know, there's pipelines being developed into those areas. So we always get asked the question, which is safer, rail versus pipelines? And, you know, it's not an apple-to-apple comparison. Rail goes right through our towns. That was the way it was built, to deliver goods through towns. So the rails are going right through the middle of towns, where most pipelines were put in place to try to avoid urban areas. So to some degree, the pipelines have that in their favor. Unfortunately, when pipelines break, they can dump a whole lot more into the environment than a rail car will.
And yet, I suppose they're less likely to catch on fire, for example.
Yeah, they tend not to have that problem, especially crude oil. There's other types of products, you know, gasoline and some of the jet fuels tend to be more flammable and can catch on fire, but not as much as the rail cars we've seen disasters from.
What sort of effect have spills like the Kalamazoo River event in 2010 had on the public conversation about oil pipelines? And do you see a shift for or against them based on those events?
Yeah, I think in the last 5 years, there's been kind of a series of events that have kind of raised the profile of pipelines. you know, before 2010, pipelines to a grand degree were out of sight and out of mind, and the public really didn't pay much attention to them. Even though there had been some disasters, they were fairly well spaced out over, you know, 3 or 4 years in between them. Starting in 2010, you know, early, I think in June of 2010, there was a dump of crude oil right into downtown Salt Lake City. And not long after that, there was the dump into the Kalamazoo River and a couple more, one in Illinois. And then in September, there was a natural gas tragedy in San Bruno, California, that pretty much wiped out most of a neighborhood and killed 8 people. You know, all of those incidents happening one right after another really kind of raised the profile of pipelines. The press started paying a lot of attention, so even more minor incidents that normally wouldn't have made the news or making the news these days. So it has raised pipelines profile with the public. And at the same time, we see all of this new production going on in places like the tar sands up in Alberta and the Bakken crude in North Dakota, and a lot of the fracking going on in places like Pennsylvania. So there are already new pipelines being pushed across, you know, private property. So there was already property owners kind of up in arms about that. Now we're seeing spills going into rivers. So, you know, the national conversation on pipelines has changed a lot in the last 5 years.
It makes me wonder if that's had an effect on the still pending fate of the proposed Keystone XL pipeline. Maybe that would have gotten more of a green light if not for these events in the last few years.
Yeah, I think clearly that's the truth. You know, Keystone 1, which went into the ground and is not operation, went through with hardly a peep. And then the Keystone XL, the one that's still up in the air, you know, was right in process when all these incidents started happening. And so a lot more attention. And since it's trying to move the same type of crude oil that went into the river there in Marshall, Michigan, there was lots of fodder for the people that were worried about Keystone XL to talk about, are we doing our spill response planning right for Keystone?
As a pipeline safety expert, when you look at the Keystone project, what's your opinion of its safety?
Well, it's pretty amazing because everybody's focused on Keystone, and there's hundreds, if not thousands, of miles of other pipelines, some of them moving almost as much oil as Keystone. One coming right near the border here to us in Washington State that moves as much as Keystone, that have still kind of flown under the radar. Keystone has agreed to a whole bunch of requirements that go beyond the federal regulations, although a lot of them are kind of the regulations as we'd like them, as we hope will develop some of them from NTSB recommendations after the Marshall spill. So Keystone's going to be built better than certainly that pipeline that spilled in Marshall, Michigan. I think the bigger question about Keystone is, should we really be transporting that type of oil, knowing what we do now about the effects it has on climate, and mainly with that oil going to export to other countries versus, you know, our own security needs?
Yeah. Would you say that it would be better to leave that heavy tar sands crude oil in the ground in Canada rather than moving it anywhere?
Yeah, that's kind of an area that the Pipeline Safety Trust hasn't really got very deeply into. You know, I think more and more is coming out all the time on climate change, whether you're talking about this type of heavy oil or coal. Certainly we need to start addressing those climate change issues, and we need to start addressing them pretty significantly. And unfortunately, we don't seem to have a national energy plan that does that.
Yeah. There must always be some risk that if you've got a pipeline running through an area, it'll leak or someone will crash into it or find a way to poke a hole in it. In other words, that it could rupture no matter how secure it is. And so as someone who's interested in pipeline regulation, I'm wondering, where do you draw the line at acceptable risk?
Well, you know, we've pretty much joined with the industry. I think we were the first one to say it at Congress that the goal really shouldn't be an acceptable risk. The goal ought to be zero incidents. And just about the entire industry, both natural gas and oil side, has joined with us, and that's really the goal. And if you look at where the incidents are being caused from, you know, there may always be some level of accidents, but we're nowhere near to that point yet because there's way too many incidents still occurring that are well within an operator's control to have prevented.
For example, the spill here near Marshall, I suppose, would have, you could say it could have been prevented.
Yeah, certainly the one in Marshall could have been prevented. The one that just recently occurred out near Santa Barbara could have been prevented. There was one 3 or 4 years ago in Arkansas where crude oil, same type of crude oil, flowed through a neighborhood there, flowed down people's driveways, and they had to evacuate a neighborhood. That one clearly could have been prevented. So some of the biggest incidents we've been seeing are things that clearly could have prevented. You know, there may be incidents where lightning strikes a pipe station or something, or, you know, someone veers off a road and hits a valve. Some of those may be hard to prevent, but there's hundreds of them that could be prevented still.
Perhaps it also depends on the area through which the pipelines are running. I'm thinking of the two pipelines that Enbridge has that go underneath the Straits of Mackinac. And just recently, the Michigan Attorney General and environmental authorities in the state have been calling for an independent risk analysis on those lines and a ban on moving heavy crude through them. Does that make sense to you to focus on those pipes in the Straits of Mackinac?
Yeah, we were really happy to see the Petroleum Task Force there in Michigan focus on that line. You know, that line has been there for a number of years, so it's kind of grandfathered in. It's clearly not in a good position. I don't think if you were putting a new pipeline in, you would put it under the straits anymore. So it's certainly one of those places where it's certainly a high consequence area that you have to pay attention to well. So their call for an independent risk analysis makes good sense because, you know, Enbridge has a history of perhaps not doing the risk analysis well themselves. So we thought that was great, and we hope that somehow they can move forward on that quicker than just the recommendations seem to at this point.
If you were talking to a lawmaker about the most pressing points in pipeline regulation, what would be at the top of your list?
Oh, we kind of do have a laundry list, and actually the top of our list is a natural gas pipeline thing. You know, we've seen all of this production going in places like Pennsylvania, a lot of the fracking that's going on in Pennsylvania, even Ohio, a little bit in Michigan, creates gathering lines. There's hundreds of thousands of miles of gathering lines right now in the country, some of them as big and as high a pressure, or much higher pressure even than the line that took out the whole neighborhood in San Bruno, California. And most of those rural gathering lines are completely and totally unregulated. So that's the top of our list, getting some basic regulations on the hundreds of thousands of miles of gathering lines that are growing all over the country. You know, I think second tier is a lot of the stuff that we've talked about in relation to the Kalamazoo River spill. We really need to step up the regulations and make them more clear on how companies do their risk analysis and then mitigate for what they find. And we need better understanding of leak detection. Obviously, the leak detection didn't work there in Marshall, Michigan. The pipeline ruptured and leaked for 17 hours before anybody found it, and it wasn't the company that found it. It was someone else on the ground that finally called the company. So things like that really need to be stepped up and made more clear in both the regulations, and money needs to be spent to upgrade that type of technology to make sure it works.
Could you make the argument from an environmental point of view that the safest pipeline is one that doesn't exist, one that wasn't built because of a shift toward other kinds of energy production?
Oh, sure. You know, clearly the safest pipeline is the one that doesn't exist because there's no risk for a non-pipeline. The reality is we have 2.6 million miles of pipeline already in the ground in this country that serves people in a variety of ways. So we're not going to get to zero pipelines anytime soon. So we have to make sure that the ones we already have that we all depend on in some ways are safe as possible.
You say that even as people focus on what happens with the proposed Keystone XL pipeline, there are other pipelines being built or expanded, extended, some of them getting less attention maybe than they ought to. And so it sounds like the general trend right now is not toward a lessening or a slackening of the growth in pipeline use.
Yeah, there doesn't seem to be any push to slacken the use of pipelines. The public certainly is pushing towards that, and sometimes it's unclear on whether some of these new proposed pipelines, like the Keystone XL, will actually be approved. You know, Enbridge is expanding their whole Lakehead system around the Great Lakes there to move as much oil as Keystone will. Most of those have been approved already, and many of those expansions are using old pipelines. There's pipelines from Alberta running to the west coast near us here in Washington State. There's pipelines from Alberta running to the east coast of Canada, all trying to find a port to start exporting exporting crude oil, as well as all the natural gas development all over the United States right now. Is new pipelines are springing up all over the place to move that natural gas to markets. And the driving factor seems to be how much money can we make, how fast, versus the considerations for the environment or protection of landowners' rights or any concern for climate change.
The next time that you are speaking to Congress about pipeline safety, what do you expect or what do you hope to be talking to them about?
Well, this year is the year when they are supposed to reauthorize the National Pipeline Safety Program. Every 4 years, the overarching program of regulations in the country for pipelines gets reviewed by Congress, and this is the year when that's supposed to happen. So it's the perfect opportunity to have the discussion with Congress about closing some of these loopholes and tightening the regulations to make sure pipelines are as safe as possible. And fortunately, you know, Congress seems pretty dysfunctional these days and pretty the Democrats and the Republicans all want to argue back and forth with each other. Pipelines have seemed to be a pretty nonpartisan issue. Certainly, the conservatives in Congress want more pipelines to move products so more money can be made, but they want them as safe as possible, just like the Democrats do. So we often are able to make progress on pipeline safety when not much progress is being made on other things in Congress.
And despite not a whole lot of progress on pipeline safety since the 2010 spill, you're hopeful that this is a time when some things might move forward?
Yeah, we know there's lots of rules in the works. We hope those rules start showing up. I testified to Congress just last week on that exact issue of where the rules, and it didn't matter whether you were a conservative Republican or a liberal Democrat, they all were pushing very hard for the federal regulators to get those rules out on the ground, both to protect the environment and to give the industry some certainty so they knew what the rules were going to be they had to operate under.
Mm-hmm. Carl, we've covered a lot. Is there anything that I haven't asked about pipeline safety or regulations that you'd like to add?
Well, I guess the one thing that keeps dawning on us over and over again is that the pipeline industry and the pipeline regulators tend to be a pretty close-knit group. They talk to each other all the time. They attend the same conferences, and sometimes that closeness makes them, it's sometimes hard to know where the regulators stop and the industry begins. We think one of the key issues that needs to move forward is to insert the public into those discussions more than has happened in the past. The public being, you know, the general public, public interest groups, environmental groups, and certainly local government has a big role to play too. So we're really looking for ways to, you know, provide a larger public voice in the rulemakings, the standard settings, these discussions with Congress. The Pipeline Safety Trust here in Washington was formed after a tragedy here in Bellingham, Washington in 1999. The Justice Department set aside $4 million from that settlement to create this public interest voice for pipelines. We're still a small organization. We need help. We would love to see, we know the Justice Department probably in the next month or 2 months will be announcing big fines on Enbridge there for the Marshall spill. We think part of that money should be set aside to create something like the pipeline safety trucks in the Great Lakes region to provide a better public voice to help counteract and level the playing field.
If we're talking about bringing the public voice in, let's say I live here in Southwest Michigan and I want to participate. Is this writing a letter to my congressperson? How do I get involved or keep tabs on all of this?
Yeah, and that's kind of what's missing there now. A number of the environmental groups in the Great Lakes states have stepped up on specific issues. They've done a great job on the pipeline under the straits there, but they don't always have the whole picture, and it's certainly not their job to be focused on pipeline safety like we are. If there was an organization back there that really was focused on pipeline safety, they could help local governments and the general public know where those fulcrum points are, know when to write letters to Congress, know who to call. Right now, there's kind of a void in that type of activity in the Great Lakes area.
All right. Well, Carl Weimer, Executive Director of the Pipeline Safety Trust, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me on today.